Break it down now, Nogo ordered, and five of his men ran forward and put their shoulders to the sagging door. At their combined thrust there was a crackling, rending sound, and now the monks were screaming. Some of them had covered their heads with the skirts of their shamas so as not to have to witness the sacrilege. Others were tearing at their faces with their fingernails, leaving long, bloody gouges down their own cheeks. Again! Roared Nogo, and his men rushed the door once more, using their shoulders in unison. The lock was ripped away from its fastenings, and they pushed the massive door fully open and peered into the dim recesses of the Maktas beyond. The chamber was lit only by a few smoky oil lamps. Now, suddenly, even these non-Christians were reluctant to cross that threshold into the holy place. They all hung back, even Tuma Nogo, despite his defiant protestations of non-belief. Nahut, he looked back over his shoulder at the bedraggled and still sweating Egyptian. This is your job now. Herr von Schiller has ordered you to find the things we want. Come here. As Nahut came forward, Nogo seized his arm and thrust him through the doorway. Get in there, O follower of the prophet. The trinity of Christian gods cannot harm you. He stepped into the Makudas immediately after Nahut and shone his torch around the low chamber. The beam of light danced over the shelves of votive offerings, sparkling on the glass and precious stones, on the brass and gold and silver. It stopped on the high cedarwood altar, lighting the epiphany crown and the chalices reflected from the communion plate and the tall silver Coptic cross. Beyond the altar, Nahut cried out with excitement, the barred gateway, that is the place where the Polaroids were taken. He broke away from the group in the doorway and ran wildly across the chamber. Gripping the bars of the gate in his clenched fists, he peered between them like a prisoner sentenced to life imprisonment. This is the tomb! Bring the light! His voice was a high-pitched and frantic scream. Nogo ran to join him, brushing past the damask-covered tabard stone. He shone the torch through the bars of the gate. By the sweet compassion of God, and the eternal breath of his prophet, Nahut's voice sank from a scream to a whisper, these are the murals of the ancient scribe. This is the work of the slave Taita. As Rayan had done, he recognized the style and the execution immediately. Taita's brush was so distinctive, and his talent had outlasted the ages. Open this gate. Nahut's tone rose again, becoming strident and impatient. Here, you men, Nogo responded, and they crowded around the ancient structure, trying at first to rip it from the cavern wall by main strength. Almost at once it became apparent that this was a futile effort, and Nogo stopped them. Search the monks' quarters, he ordered his lieutenant. Find me tools to do the job. The junior officer hurried from the chamber, taking most of the troopers with him. Nogo turned from the gate and studied the rest of the interior of the Makdas. The stele, he rasped. Herr von Schiller wants the stone above everything else. He played the torch beam around the chamber. From what angle was the Polaroid tick? He broke off abruptly and held the light on the damask-covered tabard stone on which the velvet-cloaked tabernacle stood. Yes, cried Nahut at his shoulder. That is it. Tuma Nogo crossed to the pillar with half a dozen strides and seized the gold-tasseled border of the tabernacle cloth. He pulled it away. The tabernacle was a simple chest carved from olive wood, glowing with the patina that priestly hands had imparted to the wood over the centuries. Primitive superstitions, Nogo muttered contemptuously, and picking it up in both hands, hurled it against the cavern wall. The wood splintered, and the lid of the chest burst open. A stack of inscribed clay tablets spilled out onto the cavern paving slabs, but neither Nogo nor Nahut took any notice of these sacred items. Uncover it, Nahut encouraged him. Uncover the stone. Nogo tugged at the corner of the damask cloth, but it caught on the angle of the pillar beneath it. Impatiently he heaved at it with all his strength, and the old and rotten material tore with a soft ripping sound. Taita's stone testament. The carved stele was revealed. Even Noga was impressed by the discovery. He backed away from it with the torn covering cloth in his hand. "It is the stone in the photograph," he whispered. "This is what Herr von Schiller ordered us to find. We are rich men." His words of avarice broke the spell. Nahut ran forward and threw himself on his knees in front of the stele. He clasped it with both arms, like a lover too long deprived. He sobbed softly, and with amazement Noga saw tears streaming unashamedly down his cheeks. Noga himself had considered only the value of the reward that it would bring. He had never thought that any man could long so deeply for an inanimate object, especially something so mundane as this pillar of ordinary stone. They were still posed like this, Nahut kneeling at the stele like a worshipper, and Noga standing silently behind him, when the lieutenant ran back into the cavern. Somewhere he had found a rusty mattock with a raw timber handle. His arrival roused both men from their trance, and Noga ordered him, "Break open the gate." Although the gate was antique and the wood brittle, it took the efforts of several men working in relays to rip the stanchions out of their foundations in the rock of the cavern wall. At last, however, the heavy gate sagged forward. As the workers jumped aside, it fell with a shattering crash to the slabs, raising a mist of red dust that dimmed the light of the lamps and the electric torch. Nahut was the first one into the tomb. He ran through the veil of swirling dust and once again threw himself to his knees beside the ancient crumbling wooden coffin. "Bring the light," he ordered impatiently. Noga stepped up behind him and shone the torchlight on the coffin. The portraits of the man were three-dimensional, not only on the sides but on the lid too. Clearly the artist was the same as the one who had executed the murals. The upper portrait was in excellent condition. It depicted a man in the prime of life with a strong, proud face, that of a farmer or a soldier, with a calm and unruffled gaze. He was a handsome man, with thick blonde tresses, skilfully painted as if by someone who had known him well and loved him. The artist seemed to have captured his character and then eulogized his salient virtues. Nahut looked up from the portrait to the inscription on the wall of the tomb above it. He read it aloud. And then, with tears still backing up behind his eyelids, he looked down again at the coffin and read the cartouche that was painted below the portrait of the blonde general. "Tanos, Lord Harab," his voice choked up with emotion, and he swallowed noisily and cleared his throat. "This follows exactly the description in the seventh scroll. We have the stele and the coffin. They are great and priceless treasures. Herr von Schiller will be delighted."
"I wish I could believe what you say," Noga told him dubiously. "Herr von Schiller is a dangerous man."
"You have done well so far," Nahut assured him. "It remains only for you to move the stele and the coffin out of this monastery to where the helicopter can fly them to the Pegasus camp. If you can do that, you will be a very rich man, richer than you ever believed was possible." This spur was enough for Noga. He stood over his men as they laboured around the base of the stele, digging in clouds of dust, levering the paving slabs out of their mooring. Finally they freed the foundation of the stele, and between them lifted the stone out of the position in which it had stood for nearly 4,000 years. Only once it was freed did they realise the weight of the stone. Although slender, it was a solid half-ton weight. Nahut went back into the quiddist, and ignoring the rows of squatting monks, pulled down a dozen of the thick woolen tapestries from the walls and had the troopers carry them back into the muqaddas. He wrapped both the stele and the coffin in the heavy folds of coarse-spun wool. It was tough as canvas, and afforded the men who were to carry it a secure handhold. 10 of the burly troopers were able to lift and carry the stele, while 3 men were able to handle the wooden coffin and its desiccated contents. This left 7 armed men free to provide an escort. Then the heavily burdened procession moved out through the ruined doorway of the Holy of Holies into the crowded central quiddist. As soon as the assembled monks realized what they were carrying away with them, a shocked babble of voices
of lamentations and exhortations rose from the squatting ranks of holy men.
"Quiet!" Nogo roared. "Silence! Keep these fools quiet!"
The guards waded forward into the mass of humanity, clearing a passage for the treasures they were plundering, laying about them with boot and rifle butt, shouting at the monks to give way and to let the staggering porters through. The hubbub rose louder, the monks encouraging each other with their howls of protest, whipping themselves into a frenzy of religious outrage. Some of them leapt to their feet, defying the commands bellowed to them to remain seated. They crowded closer and closer to the armed troopers, clutching at their uniforms, chanting and whirling about them in a challenging display of mounting hostility. In the midst of this uproar, suddenly the spectral figure of Jali Hora reappeared. His beard and robes were stained with blood. His eyes were crazy, bloodshot and staring. From his battered lips and ruined mouth issued a long, sustained shriek. The ranks of dancing monks opened to let him through, and he rushed like an animated scarecrow, with his skirts flapping around his thin legs straight at Colonel Nogo.
"Get back, you old maniac!" Nogo warned him,
and lifted the muzzle of his assault rifle to fend him away. Jali Hora was far past any earthly restraint. He did not even check, but ran straight onto the point of the bayonet that Nogo was aiming at his belly. The needle-pointed steel stabbed through his gaudy robes and ran into the flesh beneath them as easily as a gaff into the body of a struggling fish. The point of the bayonet emerged from the middle of his back, pricking through the velvet cloak, all pinky smeared with the old man's blood. Spitted upon the steel, Jali Hora wriggled and contorted, a dreadful squeal bursting from his bloody lips. Nogo tried to pull the bayonet free, but the wet, clinging suction of the abbot's guts held the steel fast. And when Nogo jerked harder, Jali Hora was tossed about like a puppet, his arms flapping and his legs kicking and dancing comically. There was only one way to free the blade of a bayonet that was trapped like this. Nogo slipped the rate of fire selector on the AK-47 to single shot. He fired once. The detonation of the shot was muffled by Jali Hora's body, but was yet so thunderous that for a moment it stilled the outcry of the monks. The high-velocity bullet tore down the entry track of the blade. It was moving at three times the speed of sound, created a wave of hydrostatic shock behind it that turned the old man's bowels to jelly and liquidized his flesh. The suction that had held the bayonet was broken, and the blast of shot hurled Jali Hora's carcass off the point of the blade, flinging it into the arms of the monks who were crowded close behind him. For a moment longer, the strained, unnatural silence persisted, and then it was shattered by a higher, more angry chorus of horror from the monks. It was as though they were compelled by a single mind, a single instinct. Like a flock of white birds, they flew at the band of armed men in their midst, and descended upon them, intent on retribution for murder. They counted no cost to themselves, but with their bare hands they tore at them, hooked fingers clawing at their eyes, seizing the barrels of the levelled rifles. Some of them even grasped the blades of the bayonets with their naked hands, and the razor steel sliced through flesh and tendons. For a short while it seemed that the soldiers would be overwhelmed and smothered by the sheer weight of numbers. But then those troopers carrying the steely and the coffin dropped their loads and unslung their weapons. The monks crowded them too closely for them to swing the rifles, and they were forced to hack and stab with the bayonets to clear a space around them in which to do their work. They did not need much room, for the AK-47 has a short barrel and compact action. Their first burst of fully automatic fire, aimed into the monks at belly height and point-blank range, scythed a windrow through them. Every bullet told, and the full metal jacket ball whipped through one man's torso with almost no check, going on to kill the man behind him. By now all the troopers were firing from the hip, traversing back and forth, spraying the packed ranks of monks like gardeners hosing a bed of white pansies. As one magazine of 28 rounds emptied, they snapped it off and replaced it with another, fully loaded. Now Hoot cowered behind the fallen pillar, using it as a shield. The roar of gunfire deafened and confused him. He stared around him and could not credit the carnage he was witnessing. At such close range, the 7.62 round is a terrible missile, which can blow off an arm or a leg as efficiently as an axe stroke, but more messily. Taken in the belly, it can gut a man like a fish.